Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 5th, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, we had a nice little home game.
We did. It's been a while again. I always hate that we always say it's been a while.
Just,
need to get better at that.
Hey, we're busy. I mean, there's certain things that have to happen, and things take backseats to other things, but we're back on track. We were playing the home game. May have another one planned for next week, and who knows? I think Gambit said he might have one coming up pretty soon, too. So,
wow.
Getting back in the groove.
Back in the groove.
Must be the World Series and motivating everyone.
Yeah.
Try to build their bankroll off of us.
Right, exactly. With our $2 Skittle games.
But some pretty cool stuff happened in our home game. One, we got two new people to the game who were very good players.
Yeah.
Made us better, I think.
And a lot of fun, too.
They were a lot of fun. They knew the people we knew, which is kind of cool. So we had stories about people that they knew and stuff. So it was a real good addition to the game, and I look forward to those guys playing regularly with us, hopefully. And some other cool stuff happened too. We had quads three times in one afternoon, and I flopped them. I think they were flopped at least twice.
They were. Oh. Live poker's rigged. I've been saying this for a long time.
It is rigged. Once was in Hold'em. Once was Omaha too, though, so that's kind of like, yeah, whatever. But
so it's
three
like
times. Yeah. But it's pretty crazy. When you consider how many hands we'd really deal over a 5 or 6 hour period. That's pretty crazy to see that many quads.
Definitely, particularly the variety of games we deal, too. I mean, some of them are not fast games to deal.
Right, exactly.
I'm playing Hold'em, or Limit Hold'em all day, which goes super quick,
Yep.
But yeah, that was pretty crazy. And we had a couple draw games where we really stretched the deck.
That's
probably
right.
The way to say it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there's even a stud game where everybody stayed in and everyone's arguing about what to do. They started to deal out wait, we only have a few cards left. We didn't know. No, you're supposed to do the spinner. Do the spinner, And they're like, what? The community card? And they're like, oh, all right. So kind of backtrack the cards. And then, so it helps to have Robert's Rules or whatever, queued up on your smartphone, which we didn't do. We didn't actually address them because we just all agreed that let's do the spinner. But, yeah, the draw games and then even once in stud, we were a little rusty, I think.
Yes, it's been a while. And we also had, we had eight people, too. So sometimes these triple draw games get really dicey with that. I mean, we always make the dealer sit out, so. But, that still leaves seven people. And, if all seven were fish like we all are, you're going to be keeping that bobber in the water all the way to the third draw. And again, it just kind of reminds you that sometimes you need to slow down and think about the game and maybe, have two people sit out so you don't get into those situations. I mean, no one ever wants a spinner. It's just what you got to do at the end. And I guess, we should explain that's a community card. We just don't have enough cards to give everyone instead. I think that was kind of you're right. I think rusty is the right word for us.
Yeah.
this home game, so let's not get rusty again.
there was a couple of times where I think you were like, oh man, oh wait, I got aces up, or Scott, what is up with you? It's just we haven't played enough.
Fuck that hand too. Like, oh man, hold on. And I had to profusely apologize to one of our new players to make sure he didn't know. I knew I wasn't gloating. I just was happy that I realized how much of an idiot I was.
I'm not slow rolling, you promise.
I'm not terribly sure there's a difference between the two, but I wanted to at least try to clarify in case there was. we always talk about Crazy Pineapple and how just frustrating that game can be. I mean, it's certainly not frustrating like Raz, where you just brick, 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 brick. But part of the reason I like pineapple is it really a crazy pineapple. I don't, the regular pineapple, which I think we played once, and it just doesn't do much for me. But but crazy is a completely different game, I think. And that's when you get, it's like Hold'em, but you get three cards, and you discard one after the flop. So, and by doing it that way, rather than regular pineapple where you discard before the flop, it really forces you to make some gut-wrenching decisions. And I had a hand in particular where I had three consecutive cards, and the flop came. So all of them would have been, if I got any of my three cards, I would have had a straight. Mm. The problem is, you got to throw one of them away.
Right.
So really, at that point, I mean, it's not even like these decisions that you have in pineapple where, you know, hey, should I keep my two pair and go for the flush kind of decisions. This was, everything I do, I'm going for a straight.
You're throwing one of your outs away, basically.
Yeah, so I'm just throwing one away, and it's like, you know, it's like playing bingo. You know, there's no strategy whatsoever. You're just picking one and hoping that's the one. Now, obviously, I guess, to the extent of their strategy, what I did is threw away the smallest card, so in case, you know, I paired, maybe that might work, but, you know, not. I had no faith that a pair of eights was going to win this hand in pineapple. So that's what I did, and fortunately, I threw the right one away. I mean, that's one of those things where you sit there and you agonize, and you know, hey, I'm just going to get screwed. There's no way I'm not going to get screwed on this hand. I'm going to pick the wrong one, threw it away, and then you see that beautiful card come. Oh my gosh, I threw the right one away. And then I ended up splitting the pot with another guy. We both had 8-5 in our hands. So you go from this, like, agonizing which card to throw away, to throwing one away, and then hitting the miracle card and being redeemed. And then turning it over after capping all the way to the end and kissing your sister.
What's hilarious to me is you guys were far enough away from each other that at least one of you wasn't in the blind. And yet yes. You had 8-5 in your hand. Okay, that's the thing. I would assume it would be you who would have 8-5 in your hand and not be in the blind and play the hand, but it could have been whoever. I forgot who you tied with.
You know, I do believe I was in the blind.
You were. All right. Yeah. So then someone else in our game plays as loose as you. I mean, unless you had another 8 or another 5 or an ace that suited with one of those, maybe you play it, but do you really come into a hand?
I can guarantee you it was 8. My hand was 8-5-4. I don't know.
8-5-4, yeah.
What he threw away. But and my 5-4 were suited. And yes, I do remember where I was in the blind, because I'm like, you know, this is a hand that I'm just crazy enough to play outside of a blind, but I'm in a blind, so.
So yeah. Someone played 8-5 then, like on the button or, you know, somewhere in where they weren't putting money in, forced, and that's just pretty funny to me. But
yeah, well, maybe it was ace 8-5 with the suited ace, maybe, you know, you never know. But he really had to hit at that point. I mean, I guess I did too much, I threw my card away, but. But crazy how that stuff works.
Yeah, and that's why they call it that. I kind of enjoy straight pineapple just because it's like you're back to hold them, but you get that one extra card to pick aces and go all in, or, you know, and get somebody crazy thinking, I'm just going to call with their kings, thinking it's good when you were dealt three cards and you went all in, so clearly you have to have aces, you know. But crazy is what makes it fun and makes it, you know, people think and everything.
I definitely don't mind the good old-fashioned missionary pineapple, but I just think the crazy pineapple has so much more strategy.
Sure, absolutely. And more problems, too. But we did add a cool game, Big PLO. Had a monster pot in that one. Big PLO, for those of you who don't know, pot limit Omaha, but you get 5 cards. So you're still playing pot limit Omaha, you just get that extra card to give you that extra goodness to lure you along and make you lose lots of money. So it's just like Big O, which is Omaha with 5 cards but limit. This is just PLO. So
yeah, in bar parlance, it would be Liquid Courage. You
know. Yeah.
That last card just, you know, and I'm not sure if I should play this hand. Oh, but I got this extra card now. I gotta play now, right?
And the good thing is, in Big PLO, you're always suited at least once.
Yes. You know, that's something I hadn't thought about, but somebody brought that up, and it's so silly that I hadn't thought about it, because it makes perfect sense. But, one more reason that it just, you know, you're going to build a bot there, because, you know, hey, at least I got a flush possibility.
Yeah, I have one flush possibility in here, maybe two. So it was cool. I remember I did have one hand in particular where somebody bet, like, pot, and I had, like, every single card in my hand made me a full house or a straight if it came on the turn. Or the river. I can't remember which it was, but it was a pretty big bet, and I had to make a really big call. But I just felt like the implied odds with another player in the hand who was pretty loose and generally would make a good call at the end and might call behind me. So I made a big call, hoping to Darwin that, you know, I hit my hand, and I did hit my hand, and it was a huge pot. It was like a 120 Skittle pot or something. And for our game, that's pretty big. And it all came in big PLO. So that's a game. You want big pots, you're going to get them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to get them. So that was a fun game to play. And
you know, a game where you're not going to get big pots. Triple draw high.
Yeah, you know, this game baffled me because it had been called.
All of us.
It had been called like a bunch of times in the history of our home game, and everyone looked at me like I had the plague.
Here's the thing is your life is so focused on poker that I think you dream about poker. And I'm quite certain you've dreamt all these times that we've called this game, because when you say, oh, we played it all the time, every single one of us,
I know,
including the two new people, said, no, I've never seen that been called in our
game. I can't believe it. We've played it, and even I know it was played at Gambit's game. I know it was. So anyway, I call triple draw high. You know, so no more making deuce to seven or ace to five or badoogie or... No, this was trying to make a good hand. So you could be dealt a good hand and just keep trying to improve it, and people want to stick around. I thought big pots. Did it once. Everyone stayed in. We ran out of cards. And they're like, all right, let's change it. So I changed it to, like, pineapple or something. I don't even know what I changed it to, but... Yeah, so don't play triple draw high if you have a lot of people
in
your game.
You're four-handed, yeah.
Yeah. But well, I thought that would be
the
big pots.
Between the two. Yeah, because the triple draw deuce to seven, generally you're not in that unless you're drawing one or two cards.
Yeah.
Unless you're in a blind, then you're turning three.
Right.
But in high, it's very common to be drawing three cards. You got a pair of aces and then three crap cards, and there's no reason to keep any of the other three. So, you know, you're more likely to be drawing more cards with good hands.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets really...
So don't do it. Unless you want to have a double deck or something, where you play, you know, two decks or something. I don't know. But you run out of cards pretty quickly when you're
awesome.
Playing high.
Yeah.
That would be cool. I got eight
five
aces.
Five of a kind.
And, you know, and the other thing, too, is when we played regular draw, you know, we played it pretty big. I think we played it... It was big. And because you only have, like, two streets to bet on. Or two rounds. And the one time, I played one hand the entire round. I got three deuces or three sixes or something, three eights, something like that. The one hand I play, someone gets a straight dealt to them, and they stay pat. So I raise, how many re-raises? I call, they stay pat. I'm like, great. So I have to make quads or a boat, and of course I don't, and I fold three of a kind, and Faso's like, wow. You folded three of a kind? That's a disciplined fold. I'm like,
yeah.
I'm a disciplined player. But really, I don't know who it was. Somebody had to straight. It might have been the new guy. But yeah, it's fun to get together. And when you have new people, too, they call different games, you know? So that's always fun, too, to add a good variety into your game of people and stuff. So we had a lot of fun. I have to admit that it was the biggest session I've ever had in our home game ever.
Really?
I took home the most I've ever taken home ever in our game, and I felt really good. And it was kind of under the radar, too, because about 2.5 hours in, I was only up about 10 Skittles.
Yeah, I would say, because one of the new guys really cleaned up, and
yeah.
I think all of our focus was on him,
yeah.
Including a massive pot where it was all under cards, and the other new guy turned a set, and then he rivered a set.
Yeah, he did, like, rivered a big one pip higher.
Absolutely brutal. It was just a brutal thing. That was tough.
And I thought to myself, wow, somebody could easily have eights here and have a straight, and they shoved and called instantly, and neither of them had an eight for the straight. They just had sets, and I thought, wow. You know, that to me, that how quickly it happened. Not that it didn't make sense. If you think about the hand, maybe they probably didn't have an eight, but just how quickly it was all in call. I was like, wow. And yeah, it was
and even more
pot.
Interesting is after the hand, it was jacks over tens, and I threw away jack 10.
Yeah,
I was thinking about calling at one point on the flop with that. So those are both the case cards for both of those players.
Consecutive
hands.
Streets, too. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That was really bizarre.
And if I was just a stupid player, I would have been in, too, and I would have been felted, too. But fortunately, I was just not as stupid as I normally am.
Not as stupid as the 8-5. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You were in the blind there, so you get a pass. But anyway, it was a good home game, and hopefully we're going to have another one pretty soon and have some more stuff coming out of that for one of our future shows. But always good to get together and play.
Absolutely. And, you know, I I always appreciate when I get to be on the other side of the interview and do a, you know, either a podcast or radio show. You know, I'm on Fifth Street Radio every Wednesday, except when you spell me, and used to do Poker Wars with Antonio every Monday. Kind of missed doing that. Poker Geek hooked me up with the good folks at the CPL Poker Podcast. They're based up in Minneapolis, and of course we have our Antioch Poker Tour event at Running Aces up in Minneapolis coming up here in just 1 week. And so they wanted me to have wanted to have me on the show to talk a little bit about that. And folks can go to cplpokerpodcast.com and listen to it. I think they did a really good job. One, I was really impressed with the research they did. You know, sometimes you get into these. I mean, I think that's one of the one of the hidden things in journalism that people miss, that doing your research ahead of time and asking good questions ends up making a better interview than, you know. In fact, at one point, I think one of them was like talking about how he was, Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live. You know, oh, so you guys do Antia Magazine. That must be really cool. And they didn't. They were like that. They had really good questions. The reason I bring up, other than just give them a plug and get them a couple more listeners, is that they started off the show by telling me that Ante Up was their inspiration to do their show.
Oh, cool.
That always feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Never thought it'd be inspiring to anyone. but that's always good to hear. And then the second thing is they were really truly impressed with, I guess, what we're calling now the streak.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone nearly 8 years without missing a show.
Yeah.
And they've been doing it, I don't know how long, they told me they've been doing it, but obviously they've missed some shows already. So, you know, no streak for them right now. And they just really were impressed that we were able to put together a streak like that. And of course, obviously, I'm always very proud of that too. But I was a little lost at the time talking about it, and you know, they're asking you, how are you able to do it? And you know, I gave them what I hope is probably a decent answer. But I thought about it afterwards, and you know, I started thinking about it, and you know, when we first started, probably our first 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. We were working for the Times, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, those first 3 years were really easy to keep the streak alive, because I was editing business copy, you were designing pages. Not that I dreaded going to work every day, but I certainly didn't wake up every morning and go like, oh, I can't wait to see how the Dow did today. So, you know, the podcast was like the highlight of our work week, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
One thing that we look forward to, and absolutely. I mean, the building could be on fire, and we'd be like, no, we're doing the podcast. Got to get away from the business desk for a couple of hours. So that was pretty easy, I think. And then we started the company, and, you know, no surprise to anyone, I think, that, you know, obviously the first year of the company was really stressful for us, you know. Times wondering, you know, did we do the right thing? Are we going to make it? And through that, I think, again, the one thing that we always look forward to was doing the show. I mean, because that felt right. You know, everything else we were doing was brand new to us, but exactly. The show always felt right, right? So you definitely didn't want to miss that. So really, I think for the first 4 years, we had a real motivation beside just, you know, trying to have a streak that was uninterrupted of doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are, if you do think about the times, though, I mean, there were occasions where one of us was going to be on vacation, and we still did the show. And I would think that when you're at the times, you weren't getting anything for it. I mean, we got to work, you know, we got to, you know, do it on the times dime or whatever while we were doing the show. But really, there were probably plenty of occasions where we could have been like, hey, man, you know, I'm going on vacation. You know, let's just put the show on wraps for a week, and then we'll come back next week. We're not going to lose people because we're off 1 week.
Right.
But we didn't do it. We kept either doing the show 2 weeks before, or we called in. And, you know, the times when you called in from, what was it, Seattle or Vancouver or something.
Yeah.
And then I would call in from Connecticut or wherever I was. And, you know, it was just devotion to the show and then the listeners and stuff. But I think there was an easy way to get out of it. I even had surgery.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, you scraped half your colon off your hip, and I'm like, how you feeling, buddy? Good? All right, cool. Hey, I got a show to do.
So, you know, now I think the streak is alive because it's just, it's taken on a life of its own.
Yeah, we just don't want it to end.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, and there's plenty of good reasons for it to end, but just not going to.
Yeah. It was easy when you know, when PokerStars was in our corner, and yeah. You know, you knew that they were supporting us and they
That's
were sponsoring
too.
It. So that, you know, hey, you got to do it because they're sponsoring you, you know, that kind of thing. But once they let go after Black Friday, I'm kind of like, yeah, it's going to be tough for you to keep streak alive because I'm going to be looking to say, let's not do it this week. But I've never said that to you, so we keep it alive. I think if you ever came to me and said, let's just not do one, I'd say, okay, let's take a break. Because you know what? That would have like our most listeners ever the week after. Because everybody would be like, whoa, the streak's over. How are they going to explain it and whatever? So
you losers, we told you you couldn't do it.
You don't
care about us.
I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, the Iron Horse, he had to take a break, but it was because he got sick and died. So I don't want that to happen to us. I want us to be able to take a break before one of us gets sick and sick and dies. Yeah, you know what I mean? So the streak's going to have to end someday, and I don't want it to end because of death. So
you're making me worry now. Now I'm thinking we're going to need to record a couple Evergreen shows.
Just a couple.
Yeah, so just to keep the you know, maybe there's cryogenics or something after that, you know, you can put my head back on or something, only hang out with Walt Disney for a while and come back, you know.
One show.
I'm not ready to concede that death is going to end the show.
One show to get through the illness, one show to get through the funeral, and then you have a new co-host with you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it is on my mind a lot when I think about, you know, hey, I'd like to take a long vacation once. You know, who's going to upload the show since I do it from home? All right, we got to figure this out someday. So, I don't know. But the streak's still alive. We're not doing anything. We're not planning on ending it. So, but that's cool. Those guys, not only did we inspire them, but they respect what we've done. So that's always good.
Yeah, so definitely check out Mark and Phillip's work at cplpokerpodcast.com.
They've been in the magazine too. We've mentioned them in the Minnesota column too. So
real nice guys.
Yeah, so we pay it forward. Hey, we got a hotline, 813-448-1120. If you call it and we use it, we will give you something cool. This comes from Gilbert.
Hello, this is Gilbert from Austin, Texas. I'm calling about if you could explain implied odds a little better. I saw a PokerTube explanation of implied odds saying that if you're calling a bet, and the bet comes up to 100, and you've got the draw to nut flush, and you're thinking about your future bet on the river, sort of mumbled expression like that.
All right, I'll take a quick stab at this.
All right.
Obviously, it's far more complicated than I'm going to explain, but I don't think Gilbert's looking for a complicated answer, is he?
I don't think so. It didn't sound like it.
All right, because obviously, if you want a more complicated answer, our good folks at Google can probably help you out with that.
But. Yeah, yeah.
But I think the easiest way to explain it is just if you believe that if you hit your card, well, let's say you have a flush draw, and you believe that if you hit your card on the river, that your opponents will still put more money in the pot. Then at that point, you can count whatever money you think that they are going to put in the pot, or chips, if it's a tournament, as in your calculation on whether you have pot odds. You don't have to just count on the pot right now. Now, where it gets tricky is knowing whether your opponents are going to put that money in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of beginning players think that, you know, automatically that money's going to go in the pot. You know, people are still going to bet into me even if the flush comes. And that doesn't always happen.
I think
a lot of people are very smart and like, oops, flush got there. That's the only reason that he's in this pot is because he's got a flush. I'm not giving him another dime. If that's the case, then you have zero implied odds. But that's what gets really complicated with it. So that's my simple 15-second explanation.
No, and that's very good. And I hate implied anything because you're now, instead of using real numbers, you're getting into someone's mind.
Right.
And you can never get into somebody's mind 100% accurately. So whenever I use implied odds, when I think I might get paid off, it's when I'm having a well-disguised straight.
Exactly.
Like if I have a double belly buster where it's not an obvious open-ended straight draw that could be out there. It's one of those double belly busters where they can't really put you on a straight and it's well disguised. Then I think about the implied odds because if my straight gets there, he doesn't realize the straight or she doesn't realize, and they may still keep putting money in. And then I think it's possible. So then I'll say, okay, I don't really need to have the exact odds or even close enough here to make this call because if I make my hand, there's no way they're going to see this straight and they'll probably bet again or call a bet or whatever. So that's really the only time I use it, and I'm not saying that's what you need to do, or I'm not saying that's the only way, the only reason to use implied odds. I'm just saying that's when I'm comfortable, because like Scott said, most of the time when there's two of a suit on the board, Everyone sees that. You're not the only poker player who can see a flush draw. So, you know, so that to me implied odds are just, okay, if you made the call based on what you have right now and no money in the pot, that's pot odds. If you think there's more money going to be put in the pot and you're positive of it, then you take that money, add to the pot odds you have now, and then those are the odds that you should use to determine whether or not you should make the call. So you got it right. I think it was a good way of explaining it. And I just hate that. I hate implied anything. It doesn't sit well with me because it's not 100%.
Well, again, it's like everything in poker. I mean, almost everything is nebulous. That's kind of the problem. Yeah, that's where we get in these fights with our good buddies at the Binary Bunch, you know, because they factor all that into their calculation. I'm not smart enough to do that, but you know, it's always imperfect information, and implied odds is definitely pushing that definition. You know,
agreed.
At that point, you know. Not only do you have to guesstimate whether they're going to put more money in the pot, but then you also have to guesstimate how much they're going to put in the pot. What's already in the pot, there's no question. You know, so that's one of the sure things you have. So now you've got two question marks that you got to come up with, and that makes it very difficult.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, Gilbert, we appreciate you calling the hotline. Again, folks, that's 813-448-1120. You call that, we're going to give you something great, like we are going to give Gilbert a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner and enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
We have a call to four, and I want to read it because I want you to answer it. And then I'll just come in behind you and agree or disagree.
I'm always a little scared when you're that quick on the draw.
So this comes from Ed. We have this poker league that has 15 tournaments, and your top 12 scores are used to determine who gets to play in a $1,000 World Series event. It's the final tourney of the season next month, and there are 8 players fighting for the final 2 spots. The problem is that one of the 8 just can't make it. The tourney is even at his house, and he won't be there. You get points for what position you finish. What he would like to do is buy in and just blind off. He won't be able to take possession of his stack at any time. We do allow people to register late before the first break. Usually we have a dead stack or two, just in case. This is picked up at the first break. Sometimes even sooner, depending on how fast we can break tables. We want to do the fair thing. The TDA seems a little vague on the issue. All right, what do you think?
Okay, well, this is not an issue that I think you'll ever see the TDA take up. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's a home game kind of situation, and TDA is designed for brick-and-mortar, live, regulated arena. So, to me, I don't see any problem with the guy buying in and just letting him blind off. You're not going to pick up a stack. A stack is going to be live until it is completely exhausted. You know, if he's willing to put his money in and hope that by not playing he can actually pick up some points, which actually I guess I did edit this down a little bit. You get points regardless of where you finish. So
yeah,
he will pick up some points. I don't have a problem with that personally. Now, the problem here, I think, is that this is a poker league, and these are things that I think the membership needs to vote on or really try to anticipate before it happens. At this point, you're kind of stuck. You're in the middle of the series already, right? Pretty close to the end, and now you've got this situation that's come up. So my hope is next year they're going to use this example. They'll have a good discussion. They'll come up with their best way of dealing with it now, which I think is just to let them buy in and let them blind off. But maybe not. And then next year, write that into the league rules so at the beginning you don't have any question going forward.
Right. That's smart. I agree with you. I think that somebody buys in and then doesn't play, that's up to them. But they paid for that stack, then they play any way they want. They could be sitting there and folding every hand, too. What's the difference? They paid for it, and they get points where they position. So, hey, What if you're in the tournament and somebody bought in and on the first hand gets a call from his wife who's having a baby or someone's sick and they have to go to the hospital or something, or they have a heart attack? You know, happens in the World Series all the time. Guy has a heart attack, take him off, his stack stays there, and he moves up in positions where he cashes. Happens all the time. So I have no problem with this person. Hey, he's played all year, and some unforeseen circumstances, clearly something's happened because the tournament's at his house and he's not even going to be there.
And he's willing to put in whatever the buy-in is.
Yeah,
you gotta let him do it. He's not probably not going to cash at all. He's just essentially it's a, let's say, $100 or whatever for the shot at getting to play the $1,000 event.
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely let him buy a stack and let it go off, and you know, hope it's at your table because you can keep exposing those during the blinds and stuff. You know, so I would definitely let him do it, and that seems fair to me. It doesn't seem fair to tell this guy, hey, we're going to use your house. We're not going to let you play, even though you're willing to put the money up and you've played for 15 tournaments.
Yeah, that's a tough conversation, I think, to have at that point. Because, I mean, he's not like, he's like, you know, hey, I should get points. Yeah, I'm willing to put my money up. Now, the one problem I do see in this, and it's not, it doesn't really change my mind on it, is, you know, there might have been some other players throughout the league season that couldn't make it and just thought there'd be no way in the world that the membership would allow them to buy in and be blinded off. So they didn't even bring it up. And now it's the point where it's close to the end, and, I mean, obviously this guy's not doing it the first week. You know, he's probably close to the money and needs to pick up some points. And that could ruffle some feathers. But even that, I don't think changes my mind.
No, me neither. Because they didn't think of it, or they didn't have the gall to ask or whatever, doesn't mean that someone else shouldn't be able to benefit from it because they did figure it out. You know what I mean? I know what you're saying, but I agree. It doesn't change my mind at all. I think you should be able to buy in.
Again, I mean, it's one of the things. I mean, you can't anticipate every situation at the beginning of a league that you're just starting, but I would say this might have been one of those things that comes up. You know, I think one of the leagues that actually is held at one of the rooms I play in, it's actually a sanctioned league in a room. They really did put together a really nice document before their very first year, trying to, you know, cover all these particular situations.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm not involved in it, so I don't know whether they have problems. But it certainly doesn't sound like they do. So I mean, so I guess the lesson for folks out there that are trying to set one of these up going forward is, you know, don't bash your head against the wall trying to think of, you know, hey, if a alien spacecraft comes down, it sucks up a spot, you know, that kind of crazy stuff. But, you know, obviously attendance is probably a pretty clear one that you're going to need to address from the beginning.
Yeah.
All right, now we just sent you guys something a little not too long ago, but everybody else sent your call to floors to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if it's up to that TDA level, we'll have Jody Russell, our poker manager, answer it. If not, Chris and I will just spitball it like we did today. And if we do, we will send you something great like a classic tournament dealer button from tournamentbutton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Ask about the Anti-Up logo version. And never, ever, ever forget to use code ANTIUP if you want free shipping.
Hey, Gundam Poker calls in for our feedback this week. Let's see what he has to say.
Hey, guys, this is Gundam Poker. I'm just calling to tell you that, I guess representing the binary bunch, that your comment about folding early when you have kings in the World Series and stuff, I think the math makes mathematical sense. If you're above average player in the field, then I totally agree. I think it's mathematically beneficial to wait for better spots. Now, if you're not a favorite in the field, the average player in the field, then, of course, you should take at least a 50-50 flop at any point. But other than that, I totally agree with you guys. Bye-bye.
Okay, I giggled when this came in. This came in a couple weeks ago. We're a little bit behind on feedback. I giggle because essentially agreeing with me, right?
Well,
but he's not.
He says, you guys. So did I agree with you or something? I don't remember. Did I agree with you or no?
I think I would have remembered if you agreed with me on anything.
Yeah, it must be you then. I don't think I agree with you.
But whatever. But he agrees and then doesn't agree. And that's what I think is so funny about. yeah, I remember what we were talking about was, you know, hey, what do you do if you get, you know, aces or kings or whatever the first hand of the World Series of Poker? Do you get all in? And I think we did probably agree that that's probably not something I would do, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I think I said I wouldn't do it with kings, but I think I would do it with aces.
Okay. So that part agrees in. But then, then it gets into this thing, which I'm not knocking it. It's a very good thought, that if you believe that you're better than half of the field, then no, you don't need to take those chances. But if you believe you are worse than half the field, then you have to take every chance, or at least this chance. And so here's my problem with that is, how do you know?
Yeah.
How do you guesstimate, even guesstimate, whether you're in the top 50% of the World Series of Poker main event field.
Exactly.
Because I've been thinking about this since he called, and I don't think with any degree of confidence I would say that I am in the top half.
Yeah, no.
But I might be. I don't know. I really don't think so. But I'd hate to make a decision like this for $10,000 buy-in on the very first hand, doing this extra calculation. Let me look around the room. Yeah, I think I'm better than him, him, and him. No, that guy's clearly better than me. Okay, all right, I'm in. But no, I mean, I have a little fun, but I really don't know. I mean, there was, 6,000 some people last year?
Yeah.
So that means...
Then you're like, oh no, that's Phil Locke in disguise. I thought I was better than that guy, but now it's really Phil Locke and I'm not better than him. I need to fold.
Threw me off. I'm now 49.6%.
You know what? You need the implied odds of the field. So you need to get inside everyone's head and have the implied odds of whether or not you should call this hand. Yeah, to me, I can't figure that out. If it's a tournament where I'm in our home game and I think, okay, there's like five guys in our home game that I could probably beat in a tournament, that's one thing. But we're talking about the main event or at least a big World Series event on the first hand and a field that's so massive, there's no way you could tell. So I think I'm going with my gut and folding any hand that could be beat and calling any hand that I know isn't going to be beat, which is only aces. So... And I'll take the chance because I want to double up and, you know, whatever. So, but that's pretty
funny. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I actually probably would want to hear some feedback from our fans on how they would go about trying to figure out whether they're in the top half or not.
Yeah.
In a massive buy-in field like that.
Yeah. That's difficult to do. Okay. The Antioch Poker Tour, running Aces Harness Park near Minneapolis, will host our Midwest Championship. The Antioch Poker Tour Series, April 11th to the 21st, and our good friends from Fifth Street Radio will be broadcasting live from the main event. More information can be found at antiochmagazine.com/runningaces. Also, Downstream Casino Resort will host its Four States Poker Championship Antioch Poker Tour event May 17th to the 26th, and has posted its schedule at antiochmagazine.com/downstream. More details on all AUPT events, including the Antioch Poker Tour World Championship, can be found at antiochpokertour.com.
And Walt Strakowski Jr., Antioch's 2010 Player of the Year and a single table specialist, will be the pro on our Tyler Perry's Antioch Poker Cruise, May 20th out of Miami, which will spotlight sit and goes. Rates are no longer guaranteed and sadly are inching up, but call us as soon as possible so we can get you on before they go up even higher. We also are sailing out of New York City and Tampa this year. Get all the details, including how you win your way on board at Dover Downs, and every day in April at Palm Beach Kennel Club at AntiUpCruises.com.
And our new AntiUp store has expanded the amount of AntiUp logo items available for sale, including jackets, shirts, hats, and more, and consolidate all of our shopping items as well, from subscriptions and single copies of cruises and products from our trusted partners, all on one website, AntiUpMagazine.com/shop. But now we have the return of the AntiUp News Desk.
All right, I normally don't like to give free publicity to companies that aren't sponsors, but I thought this was unique enough that I made it on the News Desk. PokerStakes.com, not to be confused with PokerStars.com.
Right.
Very easy to do. Which is a British website, has released a Poker Staking 101 guide that explains in detail the concept of poker staking, including sample contracts.
Huh.
Yeah, I just haven't seen anything like this before, and I know this is one of those issues that people probably talk about and stress about, you know, because particularly for the time I go in the World Series, you know, you're trying to get some buddies to you know, buy some shares of you. It can be very complicated, so I'm sure somebody's done one before. I'm just not aware of it, so.
Yeah, me neither. And you know what? There's a lot to think about. You know, people say, oh, you want to stake me? That's cool, and then you make money. Now what do you do? Do you share the tax bracket? We had a nice little column by Ann Margaret Johnston with the form that they make them fill out and everything to make sure that the taxes are distributed and properly or whatever, you know what I mean? So there's a lot to think about, not just the fact that the staking part of it, but what happens when you do get paid and who pays the taxes and all that stuff. So it's probably a good read.
Yeah, it includes, like, you know, makeup and markup and all these crazy concepts that if you're not in the biz, you probably don't know, and yeah, you probably should before you get involved in it.
Yeah, so good idea. A citizens group is working to get two online poker initiatives on the ballot in Washington State. One would legalize and regulate online poker in the state, and the second is a fallback initiative that would simply decriminalize the playing of online poker.
Yeah, they got frustrated with the legislature there, so they're going to the streets.
Yes.
Grassroots campaign.
Yes.
So, you know, I never try to get too excited about these because they're very difficult to get these citizen initiatives on the ballot in a lot of states. I'm not obviously deeply involved in how it is in Washington, but it involves a ton of signatures and then, of course, then it has to be voted on. But I think what we're seeing there is just, you know, residents there are just like, this is just absolutely insane.
Yeah.
That it's a Class C felony for us to play online poker. It's just that it's ridiculous. And not only is it ridiculous that we could go to jail for it, but we're missing out on all this tax revenue by not, you know, legalizing and regulating it.
Yeah, absolutely crazy.
So Godspeed up there. Is it Godspeed or is it, can I say Darwin speed?
I don't know.
It doesn't roll off the tongue much.
No.
All right, and finally, the Cleveland Cavaliers. Yes, those Cleveland Cavaliers will be selling sponsorships, including naming rights to the Poker Room for the new Horseshoe Baltimore. The Cavs owner Dan Gilbert owns Rock Gaming, which is a partner in the new casino, as well as the Horseshoe Cleveland.
Weird. Isn't that weird? Seems weird.
Well, here's the weirdest thing for me is the same naming rights to a bunch of things. You know, I can't remember exactly at all. Maybe even the parking garage for all I know. But they did specifically say the naming rights to the Poker Room. So let's set aside the fact that it's a crappy basketball team from my home state that's selling stuff for a city in a different state for a minute.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a horseshoe, right?
Yeah, it's a horseshoe.
What brand are you going to get that's more valuable to you than your own brand at this point? And that's what's kind of weird. I mean, obviously, Caesars Entertainment's struggling a little bit for money, so obviously anything they can get in terms of sponsorships is going to help. But are you really going to not brand your room, the World Series of Poker Room?
I know.
Have that brand? You're going to, we're going to take $20,000 from Pepsi instead. I just seems kind of odd to me. Now, maybe they're just throwing out a bunch of stuff and seeing what sticks. And, you know, at the end of the day, knowing, you know, hey, if no one sponsors it, then we could easily slap our brand on it. Or maybe it was just a bad press release. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's confusing.
That's what seemed kind of weird to me. If it was the Joe's Casino Baltimore, then that would make complete sense to me. But it's a horseshoe, right?
Yeah, it's a horseshoe. I mean, granted, a lot of people don't know that horseshoes are still part of the Caesars thing, you know, because they're the horseshoe, their own name. But by now, you have to know. And if not, if you don't know, then all the more reason to put the World Series label on there, you know, to get people to know it, you know. So it is kind of bizarre. But anything for a dollar, I guess. Hey, can you smell it, Scott?
I think I can.
Yeah, it's starting to cook. It's a brand new episode of O'Malley's Move.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're playing a dealer's choice home cash game, and 50 cent, $1 crazy pineapple has been called. The table's full of a lot of good poker players. However, they like action games, so it's reasonable to assume they'll be playing this game to lose. Fortunately, we are finally on the button in this one, with around our starting stack of $100. The game is six-handed. The under-the-gun calls. The MP makes it $3 to go. The cutoff folds. And we're on the button with the King of Clubs, Queen of Spades, Jack of Clubs. This is an interesting little hand here. We're going to raise to see just how strong the MP is and to thin the field. We make it $9 to go. The blinds fold, as does the under the gun, and we're heads up with the MP who makes the call. He's a tough opponent whose strong suit is reading players and knowing the situation and how best to play it. He sits with $75. There's roughly $20 in the pot, and the flop comes the King of Hearts, Queen of Clubs, Ten of Clubs. Interesting. The MP wastes no time in placing a $12 bet. Are we calling or raising? And what card are we mucking? Does it help your decision to know this player will run it twice if we ask? What are we going to do?
Pop quiz, hotshot!
Okay.
You can tell I watched Speed like 6 times. When was the last PokerCast mailbag show? If you had August 11th, 2011 in your office pool, you win. And I'm sure, you know, a bunch of our listeners sat around having a quickly create an office pool in that 3 seconds that I gave him to do it. But yeah, after nearly 8 years, we must be getting pretty good at pulling shows out of our south ends. Really, and we really didn't need to do a mailbag this week. We have a terrifically hilarious interview with Norman Chad in the can. He was great as always. But, you know, we've decided it's been way too long to go without a mailbag. We had some stuff backing up, so let's see what the mailman has delivered this week, Chris.
Well, I love that in consecutive sentences you use our south ends and in the can.
and backed up.
And backed up. So you're doing pretty good there. I think there's some sponsorships there that we could pretty much put with that
paragraph. I'm trying really hard to get in the Beavis and Butthead Hall of Fame.
All right, well, our first letter comes from Rodney Strickland. He said he's been playing poker for about a year now. Of course, we don't know how old this letter is. Could be 6 years now. Getting my start in the Bar League in Central Florida. Hey, that sounds familiar. I have recently tried taking my game to the next level, and I have been playing cash games and tournaments around Tampa. It seems like I constantly win in the 2-4 limit game, but I always lose at the 1-2 no limit tables. From what I have read, limit poker has a higher variance, so I don't know if I'm backwards or what. Is there any advice you can give to a budding poker player trying to break into the cash grind?
Well, I'll start by saying I don't believe limit poker has higher variance. Am I incorrect on that?
I have to agree with that. I've never read that. I mean, how could you win $500 on one hand and $4 on another and have a higher variance on that one? I didn't think that was true. So
yeah, I definitely think the limit game is a much better way of breaking into it. Yeah, obviously we discussed the rake before. And it's nearly impossible, if not completely impossible, to beat the rake in a 2-4 limit consistently. So I'm going to guess our good friend Rodney here has just had some really good sessions. And like anything else, you could have some really good sessions and win some money at 2-4 limit.
Yeah.
But eventually, that's a losing proposition for you. So need to bump up to a 4-8 or 8-16. Unfortunately, here in Florida, those games don't exist. So you are going to need to, if you're going to progress as a player, learn to play the 1-2 no limit. And I'm certainly trying. It's not going well. But I definitely would say that you have a ton more variance in that 1-2 no limit.
I would think you do. And just from the fact that the set of swings that you could walk away from that table losing so much or winning so much, and at the other tables it's pretty much the same. You're going to lose a few bets or win a few bets. So I don't know if I have advice for the no limit stuff, but if your advice is, if you're just looking to see what should you keep playing, well, you should always keep playing what you're winning at. So you're winning in the limit games, win in the limit games, and try to introduce a bigger game if you want to win more money. So maybe get some people to go with you and get a game going, or put it on the board. Maybe somebody want to play bigger with you. But if you're always winning at 2-4, why would you do anything else?
Yeah. And eventually, if it does catch up to you, which it probably will. Then you need to switch to 1-2. When you switch to the no 1-2, my advice there is not get cute and crazy. There's no reason to in 1-2.
No.
You know, just play solid poker. I mean, obviously there's going to be a couple players at the table that peg you right away as an ABC player, and you know that's just the way it is. But most of the players aren't going to notice and not care, and you know, you'll do all right just playing ABC poker. You're not going to, you know, clean up, but you're going to do better than trying to be crafty and trying to outcraft some people that are better than you.
Yeah, and I do notice a lot more tells in no limit hold'em, especially at that 1-2 table.
Definitely, yeah.
And that's where you should be really paying attention, is to the people who aren't as good as you. Watch them when you're in the hands, because you'll know that how they feel about their hand, and you can expose that. So that really, if you're going to play 1-2 and try to make money there, just play ABC poker, but expose the ones who aren't as good as you.
Excellent. All right, well, next one comes from Rich Santoro. And here's his question. There is, as El Guapo from the Three Amigos would say, a plethora of information. My little buttercup. Love that movie. A plethora of information regarding starting requirements for Texas Hold'em. Moreover, you guys have done a good job covering the considerations for starting hands in Omaha, i.e. the whole four-legged table analogy, cards that draw the nuts, etc. What I'm trying to prove on is starting requirements for 7-card stud and 7-card stud high-low. Do all three cards need to work with each other, like ace of hearts, queen of spades, jack of hearts? Is it good enough to have one card work with the other two, like ace of hearts, ten of spades, ten of hearts? Can we get by with just having two good cards and a dangler, like Queen Queen X or Ace of Hearts, King of Hearts, Seven of Clubs? How do we regard suited connectors like Queen of Clubs, Seven of Diamonds, Six of Diamonds, especially since position is less important and we don't get to see a big flop with 60% of our other cards in a flop? And does it matter which of our cards is in the window or door or whatever it's supposed to be called?
Wow.
You're our stud expert, so...
Yeah. Okay, let's take this question by question. Do all three cards need to work with each other, like Ace, Queen, Jack? No. They all don't need to work together in regular stud. Because you could have split aces, you know, or something like that, which would almost always be good, you know, to start with as far as what's behind you and what's in front of you or whatever. So no, they all three don't have to work together. But if you're going to go for a straight, you know, then they have to work together. You don't want to go for a straight with like Queen, Jack, Deuce and say, I'm going to go for Broadway here. You're already starting with one card out and you don't want that. So, you know, everyone always says it depends. Well, a lot of things depend. One of the things that depends is, you know, what cards are out, what cards are face up, that kind of thing, before you determine what you're going to do. So, in this instance, do they need to all work together? No. Depending on what you want to do. If you want to make a straight, then yes. You should probably have three to a straight to start. And you should really consider only high cards, because that way if you pair your high cards, then those pairs may win for you too. So, second question was, is it good enough to have one card work with the other two, like Ace, Hearts, Ten of Spades, Ten of Hearts? I think this is good. This is a good hand, good example you've picked up, because not only do you have two Broadway cards, two Royal Flush cards, a pair, but you also have the Ace, which if you make your Ace is up, might be good here. So that's a good way where two of the three cards, you know, work really well together, and then the other ones kind of work together too. So that's a good starting hand there. Now, again, it all depends. You know, if somebody has an ace showing, another ace is showing, and a ten is showing, well, you might want to consider letting that hand go, because clearly, you know, you're not going to hit another ace. It's going to have to be the case ace, and trips is going to be really rare too. So, again, it's always the face-up cards that matter. He says, can we get by with just having two cards in a dangler, like Queen-Queen-X or Ace-King-7, where two of them are hearts? Probably not. You know, one of the things is if it folds around to say the person on your right, and he folds, and you have an ace showing, and there's only small cards behind you left, then you might get away with bluffing there, and then if you hit one of your aces or kings, it's good, but you really got to know your table and stuff, so those aren't really starting hand requirements. I wouldn't look at ace, king, seven, and go, oh yeah, I'm coming in no matter what. No, it's really situational. Queen, queen, something, yeah, that would be a decent hand, because you got your queens already. The other card really doesn't matter if the cards behind you are smaller and it's folded to you. You know, if you have a king coming in raising and an ace re-raising, you might want to consider letting those queens go. As a matter of fact, I would let the queens go. So, how do we regard suited connectors like queen 6-7 or 6-7 and diamonds? Terrible. Fold it. Let it go. That's for regular stud. Stud high-low, still let it go. It's terrible. Not a good hand. And then he's saying his position's less important, but that's not really true because position can change on every hand.
Yeah.
So you have to look ahead, too, and think, okay, this guy's got aces on my right, so position's never going to change for this hand on the next two or three streets, so I know I'm always going to be acting after this guy. So there are positional things to consider. And then he says, doesn't matter which of our cards are in the window or door or whatever it's supposed to be called. It does matter. It does matter. Absolutely. It depends on what you want to do with the hand. If it's an ace showing and you want to try to steal the blinds and the antes or whatever they're called at that point, then yeah, it does matter. If you have a deuce showing, no one's going to take you seriously. The only hand that you could really give any trouble with is buried aces or rolled up deuces. So, you know, there's a lot to consider. Stud 8, stud high-low, you really do want to start with three babies. You'd love to have them suited. Not necessarily have to. One of the things when I play stud high-low is, it's funny, it's kind of like Raz for me sometimes when I'm playing. If I'm starting with something like 5, 6, 7, and I look around and see a lot of 5s and 6s and 7s out, I'll definitely play that hand. Because everyone's like, oh, don't you want to make... No, I'm not going for pairs. I'm going to make my baby straight, my baby flush, and a nice low. So if my cards are already out, then that's more cards that they're not going to make their lows with, and I already got them, so I don't need to worry about doubling them up and hurting my chances of making a low. So, yeah, your starting cards do matter, so if you're playing regular stud, listen to what I said. If you're playing stud high low, you want to really start with low cards if you can, and try to make a low, and then figure it out after that. So it's a lot. It's a lot to think about.
Very good advice. You did well with that, buddy.
Thanks, man.
The one thing I'll add is on the suited connectors. I think people do get caught up on this. I mean, the big thing I always remember about stud is it's a tough game to draw in.
Yeah.
You know, you want to play your made hands. That's why you want to be aggressive with your made hands, make people pay to draw, because you got that extra street of betting. And that extra street of betting is also at the high end of the betting, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's 20 times 1,000. Well, I shouldn't give a number, because then the binary bunch would get mad at me. It's significantly more expensive to draw in stud than it is in Hold'em or
yeah,
Omaha.
Yeah.
And so you're just better off just not doing it, and better off saving that money to punish the people that do.
Yeah, you don't want to play middling hands either. You don't want to play hands like 8, 9, 10 in any either of the games, really. Because really, all you're hoping to do is make a straight. And most guys play big cards when they're playing stud. And when they, and these, most guys play low cards when they're playing stud high-low, and they backdoor into something else. And then you're sitting there with your 10 high straight, and you've lost to a baby flush and a Broadway because they're playing high cards or low cards, and you're playing in the middle. So then, especially in stud high-low, if you see a 9... you're almost done with that hand the minute you see the 9 anyway.
Right.
So I'm not saying that's, you know, solid advice for every single hand. It's not concrete, but yeah, you see a 9, even Omaha 8, you see a hand 9 in your hand, you're like, yeah, I'm already folding. Almost always, because it's just from that point on, you're screwing yourself because you want to scoop. So you want to always try to play a hand that can scoop and split pot games. So pretty cool. Okay, let's see. This comes from our friend Dr. Frank, who was in the home game this week. Says, what does it mean to be pot committed? I mean, I sort of understand the superficial definition that after you've put a large enough percentage of your stack into the pot that it no longer makes sense to fold, but I don't understand the concept. If there is a $1,000 pot and you are more likely to be pot committed if 500 is yours than 200, does your remaining stack size come into play here? Why? What percentage of your stack has to be in the middle before you are pot committed? Or maybe the proper question is, how much of the pot has to be your contribution before you are committed? I'm so confused by this term that I never use it for fear of using it incorrectly. It seems to me that even if it only costs $10 to call a bet in a $1,000 pot, your decision to call should be based on your chances of winning, not how much you've put into the pot or how much you have left behind. If I'm holding quads in low ball or a 7 high in hold'em, I've got to fold no matter how much of my stack is in the middle. It's not mine anymore. It's a temporary property of a contested pot. If my chances of winning are less than the pot odds I'm getting, I can't be pot committed.
First, I will say, certainly no shame in admitting that you don't know what this term means. Because I think tons of people don't know what this means. Or use it incorrectly all the time. Or make bad decisions saying, oh, I'm pot committed, without really understanding it. So... I think that's the first thing to take away from this, is that tons of people don't really understand this concept.
Right.
The next thing I'll say is you're right. I don't think it has anything at all to do with how much you've already put in the pot. Well, maybe that's too strong of a statement. But I think it's very little about what's in the pot, because you're right. Once it's in the pot, it's not yours anymore. You can't reach back in the pot and take it out.
Right.
Once you commit that money, it's in the pot, so it doesn't matter how much you put in. In my mind, I think it just depends on how much you have left versus your chances of winning the pot. Now, he also brings up this, you know, hey, if you got quads and low ball, okay, well, you have pretty much zero chance of winning, so at that point you need to conserve what you have. It doesn't matter at that point. But generally speaking, that's not going to be the case. You're going to be in a spot where you still have outs or you can improve. And at that point, you have to consider what your chances are of winning that pot versus winning more money with the pot you have left. In tournaments, I think it's a whole lot easier, because at that point, then you need to make that second calculation on how valuable your tournament life is compared to what you have in there. A cash game is completely different, I think. But I don't know if that's helped at all, but that's kind of the way I think about it.
You know, and I think it's apt because we have Doc asking this question. You know, when people have something bothering them and they're sick or they have an ailment and they don't know what's wrong with them, and they go to the doctor and they get it properly diagnosed and they get a name and they can put a name to the disease. Okay? That's what this is. This is basically a term that players use to make them feel better about the mistake they're about to make.
That's an excellent point.
Right? They're like, I was pot committed. I had to call. So now they've said that so that if they make the mistake and they lose, they say, oh, I was pot committed. I had to do it. And if they win and it was a foolish play, they're like, I was pot committed. You know, yeah, I'm sorry. I had to knock you out, but I was pot committed. That's how I feel about the term pot committed. Very quickly, if you go to antiupmagazine.com and you click on the quick link on the right for Jonathan Little, you scroll down to his November, I think November 20th was when I posted it. He has a feeling pot committed in a poker hand column. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people already liked it too. People have read this. And the first paragraph, just to give you an idea, he says, I constantly hear amateur players talk about being pot committed, usually in incorrect ways. You should rarely set yourself up to be committed to a hand unless you're happy to get your money in the middle. The way you make money in poker is by making correct decisions. If you put yourself in neutral EV situations for lots of money, you're blatantly gambling, which is something you generally want to avoid. Now, he takes it from there, and he gives you examples after that of where you should not be pot committed, and that pot committed is a misnomer. And so I think you should read that column if you guys really want to get some more grasping of this concept. But to me, yeah, pot committed is just a fallacy. I don't really think that you ever are pot committed. If it's close enough where the odds are that you only have to be right a certain amount of times and you benefit from it significantly, like it moves you up in a pay scale in a tournament or something like that, well, then you're making a correct decision. So you're kind of committing yourself to that pot for an outcome. But when people say I'm pot committed, I had to call, I don't agree with it, and I think Scott's the perfect example, the short stack ninja. There are times where I'm like, God, Scott, how are you not calling there? And he's like, I know I'm beat, and I know I'm beat. Whether or not there's a slim chance of me somehow pulling it out, I know I'm beat, and I'm folding, and he has the discipline to do that. And sometimes I don't, and maybe I use that whole, there's so much money out there, I had to call. And that's the whole way of saying pot committed, but not without saying it. So I agree. I think Frank's got it right. I think he's actually determined it himself, but we just went a little further with it.
Yeah, I will say the one time that I'm comfortable saying pot committed is in a limit game on that last bet.
Yeah.
At that point, I mean, it's not like you personally are committed to the pot, but at that point, based on the way the hand's played, that the odds favor you putting that last $10 in by the size of the pot, knowing that, you know, you only have to be right once every 15 times. Now, we did talk about this at the home game, too, that, you know, there are times when I made a real bad mistake on one hand where I just really thought I was beat. And I still called because I thought there's enough in the pot that it was one of those situations where, you know, if I do that 15 times, then, you know, I hit once and I'm right. And we did have a good discussion, whereas I just really had a very strong feeling that I was beat, and I let myself still make the call based on that erroneous thinking that if I do it 15 times. You know, if you really, really, truly think you're beat, then you're not committed to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, you're in a kind of a nebulous zone where there is a possibility, and sometimes a possibility that's worth the odds that you're getting of putting that extra bet in, even if you're pretty sure you're beat. And there's a difference between pretty sure and almost sure.
Yeah, I mean, look at it this way. You have deuce, tray of spades in your hand. There's two spades on the board, and it gets all the way to the river, and you're playing your draw, and you don't get it. And the guy goes all in, and you put a bunch of money in drawing to this hand, and you didn't make your flush, and you have three high. There is no circumstance to call there, even if you have a dollar left. And there's a million in the pot because you can't win with three high.
Right.
I mean, you can't. And, so what, you're hoping that the guy had 2-3 in his hand, was bluffing the whole way, and you might tie with him? I mean, yeah, okay, so maybe there's all high cards on the board, but, you know, we're talking about 5-6-7 on the board and 9-10 or something, and you just can't beat anything because of, you know, it's just crazy. So pot committed is a terrible term. I think it is. I think it's just a crutch is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're usually what I kind of giggle at is, well, there's too much in the pot for me to fold now.
Yeah.
Well, no, it doesn't matter. I mean, you just gave the perfect example. In that situation, that dollar is worth so much more than the $1 million that you have zero chance of getting.
That's right.
All right, well, the Zam.
The Zam.
And I love this letter. All right, so he says, having arranged lots of tourneys on your cruises, I wanted to ask you, what were the general guidelines for arranging tournaments? For example, blind structure versus players versus amount of time, balancing tables, payouts, etc. And I want to tell you about the worst tournament I ever played in, worse than all caps. It was a national two-day final for a bar league. To qualify, you had to finish in the top three of your bar's quarterly season, then finish in the top 20 out of 200 players in the regional quarterly final to qualify for the national final. I kind of feel like we're on Hickory and Hoosiers.
Yeah.
The regional final at French Lick. All right, so people had come up from all over the UK for this. The tournament was terrible because top three prizes were cash and prizes, while positions 4 to 20 were just prizes. In some cases, people were manufacturing when they busted due to the prize on offer for that place. This was a two-day event, but each day started at 1 p.m. and finished at 6 p.m. 5 hours doesn't count as a day, and each day started an hour late. The first day we played down to 80, but one level was extended from 1 hour to 3 hours because we were losing players too quickly.
Oh, man.
Tables were broken at only one end of the room with players moved to the next table in, which then became the next table to be broken up. As a result, most of the players had the same table all day, or I was moved 5 times in as many hours. Day two started with 80 players, with a ship leader having only 20 big blinds. The tournament cost only £5 to enter, but made money on their bar, subs, and rebuys. From the regional and then this final. The tournament seemed to be a scam and got lots of people in a poker room and then to kick them out of the tournament as quickly as possible, so they had nothing else to do but play cash games and table games. Our bar had 3 players at this event. We stopped playing at the bar, as after this, none of us could see the point of trying to qualify again. I assume that arranging tournaments is a bit of a science, but I can't see how these guys got it so wrong. Do you have any experience of a worse organized tournament than this? And P.S. to make things worse, each player got a free T-shirt, and I was given the wrong size.
Well, here's the deal. I don't think we really arrange our tournaments that often. That, you know, we leave it up to people a lot smarter than us who do it for a living.
Yes.
But you know, there are some considerations. You know, when on our cruises, we want to have them at a certain time, so maybe it's a slow time, so we'll get people in the room. We'll set it up quickly, so we know that they'll want to hit the cash games too, because after all, it is a business. It's not just we're not just philanthropists. So those kind of things are taken into consideration. One of the things that he mentioned I didn't think was that big of a deal was the tables being broken at one end of the room.
Yeah,
because that's the way it all works, really. If you're at table one, and in most poker rooms, that's the final table of your tournament. And if you're there, you're not going to get moved all day.
You just got the luck of the draw.
Yeah, you luck of the draw. So that's generally how that works.
Yeah,
I think. But the other stuff, kind of interesting, kind of funny, and I've never played in a tournament worse than that, I gotta tell you. I think it's hilarious, the guys trying to get knocked out at certain points because they really want the boombox or they really want the iPod or you know, or something. That's pretty funny. But it does seem, I don't know about scam or not, but it, you know, you play in a free league all year and then you paid $5 to play in it, so.
Scam's a little tough. I think what we have here is just some folks that thought that running a tournament was easier than it really is. And got in over their heads in running it and essentially just didn't think it was that big a deal. You know, I think back to, you know, one of our longtime listeners, Eric, he came on one of our cruises and then he had his own show and he's like, you know, hey, if I would have done a poker cruise, I would have ran it myself and that would have been a huge mistake. You know, it was really much better by having professionals run it. And I think that's the case here. I think, you know, we've all played tournaments. We all think we know how to run a tournament. We all probably could run a tournament if somebody put a gun to our head, but that doesn't mean that we're great at it because there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that you don't think about while you're playing that the tournament director is concerned about. Well, I will say that there are a number of resources on the web where you can go. There's actually some programs, some apps where, you know, they kind of take the science and put it together for you. You know, you tell them how many people you expect, how much the buy-in is, and you can tell them how long you want the tournament to last, and it will spit out a structure that will get pretty close to that. There's a number of tournament directors that told me that stuff works pretty close to a science. And so, you know, again, with tournaments, you know, there are other considerations than making every single player in the tournament happy. You mentioned a couple too as well too. So, but again, this just seemed to be somebody that was just in over their head.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're really serious about running a tournament and you don't have the money to hire a professional, you know, avail yourself of some of the resources on the web and maybe read a little bit more about what goes into a good tournament.
I did play in a tournament once where I was a bounty, and they gave me a T-shirt to wear, and the shirt was the wrong size, and they spelled my name wrong. I don't know if that qualifies to help out, but yeah, they had my name Consenza, and then, which a lot of people who might find interesting, in the Italian language, C-O-N means with, and senza means without. So when they spell my name that way, it means
you're
nothing.
You're like, you do.
It's like with, without. With or without you. But really, it means nothing. With or without. Which is it? So I thought that was kind of funny. And of course, the shirt was like a medium. And at the time, I was very extra large. So I'm sitting around like a burrito at the table. Hardly bets and stuff. So, but yeah, that sounds like a pretty bad tournament you were in. And my apologies.
Absolutely.
Hi, this is Team Poker Stars Pro Vanessa Russo, and you are listening to the Ante Up PokerCast.
You gotta fight for your right to win.
Well, I'll make your day today, Chris. We've got an 8-16 limit hand of the week.
Yeah, can you just email me the hand and I'll read it to you?
There's no fun in that. Another long-time listener comes from Jeff Hayashi. And, Hayashi.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not even going to attempt.
I'm pretty close. I'm closer than I am with most names.
Can't be wrong if you take the fifth.
All right, so he says, this hand is more about hand reading, knowing your players, but let's see whether Chris can figure this out with a little smiley face.
Oh, man.
Throwing the gauntlet down on you, buddy.
I appreciate it.
As we mentioned, the game is 8-16 limit hold'em. It's a full ring, nine-handed. Three players, and then the button limps as well. He says the button is a very good regular player, one of the best at the table. He plays a good, solid, aggressive game, and is a winning player. The small blind calls, and I'm in the big blind with 6-4 offsuit.
Okay. And we got five players with us in the hand, right?
Yes, five players.
Okay.
Not a lot of mystery here in the big blind, right?
Right, okay. We're checking along.
We're gonna hope to flop big here, and because it doesn't cost us another dime, right?
Yeah, we're going to check along and hope it comes 4-4-4.
All right, if the flop does come, queen of clubs, seven of clubs, six of diamonds. So we got bottom pair with wonderful kicker. And it is checked around to the player on the button who fires a bet for $8. Actually, I mean, that was the only thing he could do. But maybe he had a lot of gusto in it. Or maybe he had one of those, you know, those little T-shirt guns that they have at the baseball game. Fired the $8 in. That would be pretty cool.
It's all bundled up. He's got his money all in bundles. All right, so we're looking at a roughly $40.
$40
pot, and he bets $8. So it's 48 in the pot. We have bottom pair, no draw, no kicker. We fold. Is there any reason to play this hand any further?
Yeah, I could make a case. Not a very good case, but I could make a case. If everybody checked beforehand, I mean, I guess you have to know your players. If you think there's going to be a check raise coming in, that's the last thing you want to do. But if you're pretty confident that everybody else is either just going to call or fold here, I might take a flyer on one more to see if I can get two pair or better. And the reason is that when folds around in limit, it's just like no limit. I like to take a shot at that point because if no one has anything and they end up folding and you take down that pot right then, that's the power position. And if not, you still retain, as George Costanza would say, you have hand. And, you know, you can fire another one on the turn and maybe win it there. So I don't put a lot of... I'm not giving a lot of credit to the button necessarily here at this point. And because it's limit, it's not going to cost me a lot if I'm wrong. But if I have any inkling here on the back of my neck black cat running under a ladder, whatever it is that someone's going to check raise here, I certainly don't want to be in this pot.
Let me ask you, would you consider check raising yourself if you don't believe this guy and you think you can get the other ones out for two full bets?
You know, I might, actually. I might do that, and because at that point we probably can thin the rest of the field out, because now we're small. We're check raising from the blinds, which is dangerous, and this is a blind kind of flop here.
Right.
If nothing else, you'll probably get heads up with this guy, which is good. And then you can fire again on the turn, and if he was just messing around, then he's going to fold. So, yeah, I think I would. But the problem is, I think, is that we know him as a good, solid, aggressive, winning player. And, you know, I don't know what he thinks of us. And yeah. If three bets is here, then I guess at that point we just shut down. Or if he's just not willing to play our game, then we're going to be committing more. I mean, here's the thing is, if we do check raise here, we have to bet out on the turn.
Right, we're looking at $16 now.
Right, so it's a $32 decision at that point to check raise here. And very likely, we're probably going to need to fire that third barrel on the river, and that's where limit gets a little tougher, particularly for no-limit players, because that's when you go, I couldn't get you off your hand.
Yeah.
You can't, because that's not what you're trying to do. So you're almost committing at this point $48 on this check raise with bottom pair or weak kicker.
Which is currently a $48 pot, by the way.
Right. So, yeah, I could make a case for check raising here if I felt confident that in my ability to play against this person. It's probably stronger, to be honest, than just calling here.
Yeah, I can't see myself playing this hand, but if I did, I think I would go for the check raise if I was able to. Like, if I checked it thinking, I'm giving up if there's a bet and then a raise somewhere along the line. But if I check and think they're all going to check to one guy who's going to bet and is going to get back to me and I can raise, I might attempt that. That's the only way I think I would play this hand. I would not call with this hand. Yeah. I couldn't do it. I couldn't call.
Yeah, and long term, your better play here is just to fold here.
I mean,
you got bottom pair, which is almost never going to win in limit. You got a terrible kicker. I mean, even if that four comes, now you've got a straight possibility out there, which is probably unlikely that anybody has it. So really, at this point, you're waiting to hit, you know, one of those two remaining sixes, which is just brutal. So at this point, you know, I mean, it didn't cost you anything. You're forced to put the money in the big blind. You haven't voluntarily committed anything to this hand. It's better just to let it go.
And the other thing, too, is when you bring up the four, that the 5-8 is very possible. In a limit game, 5-8 suited. You know, a small blind could have 5-8.
Yeah, but the small blind's folded by it right now, though.
Oh, he's blind, okay.
So, yeah, it would have to be somebody that voluntarily put, you know, the full bet
in. Scott Long.
Yes. Which I would not do it in 8-16.
Yeah, but you did it in Pineapple, so you were in the blind. So we're giving you that pass again.
So, yeah, I guess I really wouldn't worry about the straight too much here. But you also got two clubs on this board, too. So,
yeah.
Depending on... Again, we don't know how many other people are going to stick around after we either call or raise here. It's possible somebody could have clubs as well, too, and then that cuts your odds down as well.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to say that if I'm playing this hand, if I'm playing it, I'm check raising. But I probably would not have played this hand and would have folded to the bet and just said, let's get another hand. Now I'm going to be, you know, in position or whatever. So let's have another hand.
Okay, so this is what our hero said. He said, the button, whose name is John. Oh, he's actually personifying.
Wow.
John is a good, aggressive player. I should pretty much bet anything here, which is what I was saying. Yay. 1 point for Scott. With all the limpers, if no one connects with a flop on a draw, he can get most hands to fold. Pretty clear there is no queen since it was checked to him. I expected him to bet. For starters, there are almost no hands in which he has a queen in his hand in which he would not raise pre-flop. Ace, queen, king, queen, queen, jack, he would probably try to get out the blinds and drive the future action of the hand. Maybe he has queen, ten, or queen, nine. Actually, I kind of like that analysis. Yeah, you're right. With any of those hands, you're probably in on the button you're going to raise, particularly with a bunch of limpers. So, you know, unless he was getting frisky with something like a 7-6 or something like that, it's quite possible he has air right here.
You
which
think,
makes it all the better to check raise.
You would raise a queen jack if you had three limpers in front of you and you were on the button. You'd raise a queen jack
almost always.
Yeah, because you're in position for the connecting and all that stuff too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
All right, so our hero raises. Yay!
Yeah.
So sniff that out. See, yeah. You thought you couldn't figure this out. Which I don't know, but more. I don't know what part of this he wanted you to figure out.
That's true.
Figured out that part. And he gets folded all the way back to John on the button, and our hero says, so far, so good. Then John three bets. What to do?
Ugh. Well, if it was Scott Long, he'd have tossed his cards in the muck faster than my chips would have hit the table when I three bet him, because he'd know that he's beat. But I don't know. To me, if I was playing an R game and I check raise somebody and they three bet me and all I had was bottom pair, this guy's a good player and he's aggressive, but this is a limit. You know, it's only one more bet. It's tough to bluff somebody that early in a hand when you've check raised them. So the only way is that he's thinking that you're on a draw and he's making you pay. I've done that. I did that in that horse tournament that I cashed in at Palm Beach, where guys are trying to get free cards on me and I wouldn't let them. And I check raise and I raise them or whatever, knowing raise back, knowing that that's all they were trying to do. But in this case, you're out of position. So I think I'd give it up now. I mean, this is tough. I mean, the only way he's three betting it is if he does have 8-5, or if he has, like you said, 7-6.
I have
or
a set of 7, set of 6s. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily raise those in a limit. Pot preflop. So those are other two very legitimate hands that he could have. So yeah, I would think pocket 7s, pocket 6s, 7-6. Or the third option, the fourth option, I guess, would be that he thinks we're making a move on him. And he wants to find out, and he's willing to do it because he's in position, and maybe he has some sort of outs that gives him more confidence. You know, maybe he's got
8-9 of clubs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Perfect hand for that.
Yeah. So, there you go.
So yeah, at this point, it kind of depends on what we think John thinks of us. You know, if we think that it's possible that he's just putting us to a test here, then I'm going to raise here again and say, no, I've got this, and see whether he shuts it down. But if I don't think that he's thinking that, then I'm going to either give him credit for having a strong hand, or at the very least give him credit for being in position and we're out of position, and we tried and failed.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Let's not put more money in this pot.
So if you knew your partner, or player, I mean opponent, had 8-9 clubs, you would get out of the way because you're racing so many cards there.
Oh, absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
There's no reason to. So if you can...
Strong favor at that point.
Yeah, I think I'm getting out of this hand now that we've been three bet. I really do.
All right, so our hero says, I still don't put a queen in his hand, but there's so many draws out there that he could be on a big draw, so I call.
All right.
Okay, here my problem with calling is that now we've kind of essentially told him that our hand isn't as strong as we pretended it was.
Yeah.
So now we're almost, in a sense, giving control of this hand over to him again, which means we need to hit to improve. And we really don't know what he has at this point. So he could, I mean, if he had a set here, we're completely dead. And it kind of depends on what else he might have here, on whether any of our cards that come will improve us. And so that's tough here. I mean, I think at this point, for me, it's a fold or a raise again.
Yeah. Yeah, I just can't see putting more money in this pot with the worst pair on the board and almost the worst kicker. We made our move. It didn't work. Get out now.
All right. Well, the turn is the deuce of hearts. So our board now is queen of clubs, seven of clubs, six of diamonds, deuce of heart. It shouldn't help anyone. And I'll go ahead and say that we check, and our opponent bets.
So there's 88 in the pot before he bets. You know, so now there's 104 in the pot, and we have to bet call 16 to win 104. So it's like 8-1 on your money. With one pair, I don't know. And then the kicker too just kills me. If he has like A6 or something, you know, I'm just gonna be ripping. So. I'm just, you know, I was done with the hand before, so I'm still done with the hand. I can't imagine putting more money in this pot. And now you've checked to him after you check raise, so you're totally giving up and giving him, you know, the lead. So, I mean, if he keeps betting, he doesn't know how you could possibly, we don't know how you're possibly going to call, which is sixes. So maybe that's what you're on to with him. Maybe you think he has something like 8, 9 still. I really don't know. Because if he had any cards that were overs, he would have raised. You know? So what cards is he doing this with? It's pure air. You know, now you have to, all you have is a bluff catcher now. And you really want to have a bluff catcher in limit when he keeps betting at you? I don't know. So, again, I'm done with it, but I'm assuming he's going to call. Because why would we be doing this hand if he didn't?
Yeah. Again, I think our mistake in this hand was not raising or folding on the last street. Yeah. So now we put ourselves in a pretty much an unwinnable situation. At this point, the best we can hope for is calling here and him having air and not improving on the river and checking it down so we get a free look at the win, because I can't put $32 more in this pot unless I improve. And, you know, I don't know whether we have the proper odds of even improving. So that's kind of the problem we're in now.
And it's possible. 6-4 is not even good.
Exactly.
So, you know, you got to take that into account, too.
All right, our hero says, it's clear to John that I don't have a real strong hand since I didn't cap to betting on the flop. See, I figured that part out.
Yeah.
So we're both 1-for-1 here. It could look to him that I have a very weak queen or possibly a draw. He knows that I could also be doing this with a 7. Since I was in the big blind, he has to give me a very wide range, even 7-deuce. We know each other's games fairly well. I'm still pretty sure I have the best hand, so I call.
Would you really have 7-deuce and check the deuce after you check-raised and now you've improved your hand to 2-pair, which is what you're representing anyway, likely? There's no way you check that turn. There's no way he's putting you on 7-deuce.
Yeah,
or 7-6 or queen-7 or queen-deuce. There's just no combination that gives you 2-pair in his mind if you checked again on a turn.
Yeah, it's a tough story to put together.
Yeah.
And now we've kind of crossed this hand of the weekend to what we famously like to call in our home game the DMP, the Dog and Pony Show. Where two players know each other really well and they essentially throw out good poker sense and just know how each other plays, so they're playing a game of chicken.
Yeah.
Like faster than I always do.
Always.
And that's kind of what's going on here at this point now. You know, when he finally tells us now that we know each other's game fairly well, it makes it a little tougher going forward now in this hand, because we don't know what that history is now.
Yeah.
All right, so the river is a very interesting card, according to our hero. It's the Ace of Diamonds. So our final board is Queen of Clubs, 7 of Clubs, 6 of Diamonds, Deuce of Hearts, Ace of Diamonds. What do we do now?
Yeah, well, there's no draw got there. And, yeah, our player could have been betting the whole way with Ace High. But you said before, or he said before, that if he had any kind of good cards, he would have raised with them. So I can't believe he has an ace.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think this ace is a good card for us.
Yeah, so I don't believe he has an ace. So if I check and then he bets, I don't believe he hit the ace. So, I mean, there's so much money out there now that, you know, you only have to be right, you know, one time out of, like, what? How much money is in there? 120? So, yeah, one time, you know, to beat your hand, one time out of 11 or so. And you got those odds, so you might as well just check call now, you know, if he bets. And if he doesn't bet, then you got to see the river for free.
Well, yeah, I kind of like the options we have here. We check and hope that he checks behind and our 6 is good because he has nothing. Or we could bet here.
Knowing he couldn't have an ace because of the way he played it.
Thinking that it's more likely that we have an ace than he does, and it gives a, and so maybe he either folds because he feels he's beat, he has nothing at this point, can't call regardless of its limit and your pot odds pot committed at this point, or he raises you because he does have something, and then you could probably fold with a clear conscience, or if he really felt like it, make a call just in case he's, you think he's playing you one more time here. I think betting out here is a stronger move.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to let him raise me at this point. Because if we just check and he bets, we're probably at this point going to have to call because we've come this far, right?
Yeah.
So we might as well take the option of betting and maybe possibly getting him to fold if we're going to put that money in anyhow.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, so our hero checks again. John bets, and it's back to us. And And again, I think we just talked about this. At this point, there's so much that we put into this pot. There's so much in the pot. It's likely that he could have been betting with air. And at this point, we're closing out the betting. So the 16 is a good investment, I think, for us. With the fact that we have something here.
There's 120 in the pot at that point, I think. So I think that's what it is. I haven't figured the math out here, but I think it's 120 in the pot. So...
Right, so this is one of those situations where you have to be right in this situation just one time in, what, eight?
Like eight or so, yeah.
To make it profitable. And so, I mean, at this point, I would be shocked if we folded at this point.
Yeah. All right, well, let's just call.
All right, well, our hero says this is a very interesting river card and that all the draws miss but puts another over card on the board. Based on John's play, there are almost no hands in which he has an ace here. Possibly the only hand could be ace of clubs, six of clubs, based on the play in previous streets. He shouldn't really like the ace on the river based on my range. His hands become very polarized at this point. I either think he has a hand like 7-7, 6-6, ace of clubs, six of clubs, or something like ace of clubs, nine of clubs. I thought for quite a while on the river, probably like a minute, which is an eternity for limit hold'em. Finally, I called. John turns over eight of clubs, five of clubs.
He did have 5-8.
For a missed straight and flush draw, and my pair of sixes is good. Woohoo!
Oh, my God. I said that 5-8 was possible, and nobody, you all like, yeah, right.
And I really didn't know that when I picked the hand this week. And that's funny. We start the show with an 8-5 and end with an 8-5.
Oh, man, he had 8-5 and bet it the whole way. What was it, 8-5 of clubs, you said?
8-5 of clubs. So it makes sense. You go back and look. You know, he's open-ended with the flush draw, and he's in position. There's tons of reasons for him to be firing at this all the way to the end. It's tough on that final bet, though, to put that in. At that point, it's one of those things where I think he decided, I can't win by checking here. So I might as well put another $16 in and hope my opponent folds. Versus just checking it down and conceding the pot. And that's sometimes a tough call to make. But the rest of the hand, I think he played it well. Absolutely.
Man, that's pretty wild. I was saying 8-9 of clubs too earlier, so that's the kind of hand that he would 3-bet with you after you check raise him.
And here's what's interesting about us betting out on the river, which is what I advocated. It would have probably cost us $16, not to be results-oriented, but in this situation... at this point, you know, somebody already put the bet in. At this point, what are you going to try to do? You're not going to be able to get them off the hand by raising, so you're just going to fold here and, nice hand. And by letting him take the lead, he was forced to bet into us, and we got an extra $16 out of him. But,
man, crazy.
But on balance, I think I would still rather bet out there.
Yeah, that was crazy. Wow. 8-5 clubs. Jeez.
Well, Jeff, it's been a while since you've sent us in the hand of the week, so we're going to send you a deck of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Annie Up. You can pick up your own decks in the Annie Up store at annieupmagazine.com/shop. And don't forget to support J-Design's new Kickstarter campaign for its new lines of cards by visiting kickstarter.com and searching for J-Design, which is spelled D-E-S-J-G-N. Only a couple of weeks left in that campaign, and Jason's just announced some new colors, too, at classicplayingcards.com. So get out there, support him, and remember, send your hands of the week to podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and we'll be happy to give you something great if we use it on the show.
Hey, listeners really contributed a lot to the show this week, so I want to thank our fans and appreciate everything you guys do. And keep sending those questions and letters in. We always try to get them all on the show. So I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.